Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, we're broadcasting from the library at the Lannan Foundation in Santa Fe. There are several members of the foundation and friends listening, so we have something of an audience here. And what I have today is my guest and my friend, Gilbert Sorrentino, whose new book, Lunar Follies, is being published by Coffee House Press. Because there is nothing like a new book by Sorrentino, I thought it would be good to begin with the first sequence in this book. This is a list of galleries and their shows. They're in alphabetical order, and this is the first such gallery in the book, Alphonsus.
George Alphonsus, famed as the supreme master of magic, is said to have had a hand in creating the illusion that has, quite successfully and convincingly, asserted itself as art for our time. The question asked most frequently has been, what of the millennium? Or on occasion, what of the exciting millennium? George creates the convincing illusion, which most agree silences the seasoned and cynical journalists who are, of course, the framers of such questions as have to do with art for our time. For instance, is baseball too slow for our ultra-busy, speeded-up, on-the-go age? Will the loathsome cockroach lead the way to a cure for breast cancer? Was John Kennedy Jr. a closet queen? Do we have to die? How can we be happy in a bad job? And is birth control science the way to the rapture? But to the supreme master of magic, anent his astonishing and artistic illusions, which he insists and strongly on calling the art of astonishing and artistic illusions, they ask, e.g., how does it feel, George? Silence usually ensues, and so it's on to the snow chain story, the heat wave story, the story of the tough coach and his swell young protege, the killer hurricane with puppy story, the mudslide story and the people who will rebuild, the forest fire story and the people who will rebuild, the flash flood story and the people who will rebuild, the depraved priest story and the youths he abused every night for 9 years, and of course the magnificent new stadium that will seat 150,000, cost nothing, make an entire city rich, and stamp out the cocaine trade as well, so that the little guy, if white, will win at least maybe, story. And all the while, through rain and fog, and the golden California sun that bakes the brain right through the jaunty baseball caps that are always the rage, George, the supreme master of magic's newest illusion is, yes, right this way, over here, yes, here you go, right by the spill latte, yes, illusion.com.magicgeorge.com, you chumps.
Gilbert Sorrentino reading the first section, Alphonsus, from his new book, Lunar Follies, published by Coffee House Press. Now, the person who has gone to battle against ideas about art is one who's quite threatening. I would think that people who have read you, especially writers and artists, would fear the person who has been able to make such a profound construction of the mistakes that can be made by artists in the direction of humanism, sentimentality. Am I correct in thinking that in combating these things, this is the second front, the major question is what is art and how is it assembled out of the junk we live among?
Well, I don't think I can answer what art is. I think art is basically to perhaps be absurd, is anything that an artist makes is art. If he's an authentic artist, whatever he makes is art. It might be bad art. It might be good art. It might be in-between art, but I think it's basically art. How to judge its value, of course, is the difficulty. Making it out of the junk of our world, it seems to be the only thing you can do as an artist, is make your art out of the junk of this world. This is where we live, whether we like it or not. There's not an ideal world that we can approach. There's not an ideal world that we can, as they say, access. There's a world given us, and that's the world that we have to deal with. My beef about, you know, the well-made conventional novel is the fact that it has nothing basically to do with us. I think I can't remember who it was, but a French critic said that we live, the only art possible for our time is an art of fragmentation, because we live in a fragmented world. There's no way to make a nice novel anymore that really says anything to us. They're sort of easy to make in a way. I mean, I've never written a conventional novel because I've tried to write conventional novels, but I just get bored with them. You know, like 30 or 40 pages in, I say, oh God, now Elizabeth is going to have to, she's going to have to meet George, and then they're going to have to, and then of course, Elizabeth's ex-husband will probably. And then you plot all this stuff out, and finally you wind up with a novel which is like a good read, but like, I'm bored. And perhaps selfishly, I've always thought that if it bores me, it's got to bore other people. I may be wrong about this, but if I'm bored writing the thing, why wouldn't somebody be bored reading it? I mean, I think the nice thing about being an artist is that you can do whatever the hell you want to do. It's probably the only vocation left in the world in which you literally can do whatever you want to do. That doesn't mean it'll be accepted or even published if you're a writer, but it's a marvelous feeling to have that you don't really have to please anybody. You have to please yourself. And I think if you're honest enough with yourself and you make something good, there'll be some readers, maybe only a handful, but, you know, that's how it goes.
Now, this book is called Lunar Follies, and it seems to me from the other books that the moon is a place of special, deserving of special affection.
Oh, the moon is magical. I mean, the moon can be anything. I mean, it can be something in like 8 million popular songs. The moon exists in all sorts of ways. It can be marvelous. It can be sinister. It can be dreadful. It can be an augury of things to come, bad or good. And it can also be a place where loony people live, as they say. Or loony people are, you know, moonbeams have affected their minds. I've always been enthralled by the moon, perhaps even by the word moon. I mean, that long double O, which is absolutely marvelous. So if you're a poet, it's a quantitative word. Even though it has one syllable, it's not really a qualitative word. It's not an accentual word. It's a quantitative word, which is really interesting. It's one syllable, not at all like the same syllable as, like, not at all the way a word of one syllable like sun is. Sun is one syllable. Moon is one syllable. Moon is not really accentual. It's a quantitative word. It has like two beats to it.
Now, the galleries are all named for places on the moon. The Sea of Tranquility, for instance, the Sea of Fertility, not to mention Alphonsus or Tycho. And who's named the moon? What names are these?
I guess astronomers, I guess, name these places. I know nothing of it. I mean, I got this out of like an encyclopedia. I just figured this is a great way to organize the book. That's basically what it is. It's an organizing principle. That's all. I said, how am I going to arrange this book? Most of these people are sort of dippy, or if you will, loony, or the people that they're showing are loony, or the galleries themselves have like sort of addressed themselves to looniness. So it's sort of, well, this would probably organize the book nicely.
Now, what interests me often is there'll be an accusation, say, that bad artists are cynical. And it will be followed by an accusation toward my guest, Sorrentino, that he is cynical.
Oh, yeah.
In finding the cynicism everywhere. And so the charge gets leveled almost as a magnetic field, something balanced between two magnets. But when working within the field of cynicism, where do those other qualities that are not the puppy caught in the flood qualities, but of something that is genuinely moving, how does that peculiarly heartbreaking voice emerge? Do you distrust it when you're working toward something that now has to demonstrate art's ability to break the emotions out of their assumed associations? In a certain way, it seems to me this whole new book, Lunar Follies, is pointed toward the question, under this barrage, is there a kernel of beauty or truth that can still be found? And if it can, how, under the barrage, can I, Gilbert Sorrentino, find it?
I think what you're saying is, how can you escape both cynicism and perhaps sentimentality? Is that to make something that's, as you say, true or beautiful, or however,
or heartbreaking,
or heartbreaking? Well, that I think that's it's a very hard thing to do, because it's easy to be sentimental. It's really very easy, and you don't even know you're doing it. Sometimes you have to look at the sentences as if you didn't write them and say, "What is this junk?" You know, and get rid of it. Because what's heartbreaking in life is often very sentimental, but that's death when you put it on the page. Somehow it becomes camp. It becomes sort of a parody of the emotion you're trying to register. If you make one misstep, there's an early story which is in this book, The Moon and Its Flight. The first story I wrote, basically, the first serious story I wrote, because I'm not really a short story writer, right? I get nervous with short stories, and they turn into other things. But the first story, The Moon and Its Flight, is a story I wrote 9 times over a period of about 6 years, because I couldn't get an idea that was basically sentimental. Summertime romance, thwarted, and then revisited years later as a kind of heartbreaking, bittersweet incident that will probably come to nothing. Well, there are 8 million ways to step off the cliff when you write a story like that. And I blew this story 9 different times. I just gave it up over and over again. I couldn't get this. What is cornier than first love that goes awry? I mean, it's just aching to be bad. But I figured, well, let me embrace it in a way. And let me embrace it without being cynical, but by the same token, setting these people in like the context of their time, which was the late 40s, early 50s, a kind of desperate time in America in many odd ways, perhaps not as desperate as today, but desperate enough. And I think that's what it is. You have to make sure that you yourself become the reader of your own work so that you can see the crap that you've written.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Gilbert Sorrentino, author most recently of Lunar Follies, published by Coffee House Press. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Gilbert Sorrentino about his new novel, Lunar Follies. There's a section in Lunar Follies called Tycho where I think the ineffable moment of intolerable sadness is reached. And of course, given this world, it's put on display in an exhibition, which is going to, again, make it impossible to feel once it's been displayed. And I thought I'd ask you to read Tycho, which is the second-to-last piece in the new book, Lunar Follies, by my guest, Gil Sorrentino.
I might mention the core, the kernel of Tycho, is an old song called My Buddy, which is a marvelous old sentimental song, which yet escapes sentimentality and becomes absolutely heartbreaking song. Days are long since you went away. I think about you all through the day, my buddy. Anyway, this is Tycho. A photograph in the corner of the apartment. Cloudy, dark, difficult to make out. In a room filled with haze, a woman in a low chair, her face in her hand in a familiar female posture, weeping. Again, familiarly, bitterly. She weeps for Buddy, her dead son. Killed at the age of 16 in a fall from the parallel bars that at one time graced, God knows why, perhaps to kill Buddy, every public high school gym in New York. My buddy, she whispers, bitterly weeping. Life, despite its vaunted pleasures, can be monstrous and ruthless, utterly without pity or solace, despite sunsets and cool forests. The days are long since he died. Long. The room's haze seems to thin or lighten, but then it is again precisely as it was, so it probably never changed at all, as if a photograph could show such changes. She thinks about her son all through the day, the days, every day. Her obsession is said to be unhealthy, an unhealthy obsession. So much for the assistance from friends and providers of assistance. The world, and we know exactly what the world is, prefers that everybody rid oneself of anything that might even hint at unhealthy obsession, no matter the form it might take. It wants everybody to fall in, dress right, dress, ready front, cover. You girls gone soldier, or you be doing close order all night. No room for obsessions here of any sort. That's what the world wants. But she misses his voice. She misses the touch of his hand. Maybe she'll come out of this funk, this depression, this despair, and become once again a valuable, contributing member of society with a great deal, oh, a great deal to give to same. In the meantime, while society waits, Buddy, her sweet, handsome, funny buddy, nobody quite so true, is dead. And although, as a good Catholic, she knows that he must be in heaven with God and all his angels, he's not here. He's not here. She thinks about him all through the day. But now, wait. We discover that this is a photograph of what? A man shielding his eyes from the sunlight that enters the small room through a worn, almost transparent window shade. He is thinking about something. But what? He is thinking about the woman whose photograph he is gazing at, holding at an angle away from the glare of the sun. She is in a low chair, bitterly weeping. He has looked at the photograph every day for months, an unhealthy obsession.
Gilbert Sorrentino reading Tycho, the next to last section of Lunar Follies. Now, there are a lot of jeering voices in that, and the situation is pathetic and threatening to become pathetic, and yet the essential balance between unreasonable sadness and an unreasonable world that wants you to recover from obsessive mentation and sadness and loss, and then someone thinking about someone thinking about her loss. All of these compound to make the piece something that you'd have to have a heart of stone not to succumb to. Now, are the tears that writing may inspire themselves to be avoided? Are they danger zones for the pathetic?
I don't know how you can avoid them. I mean, if it moves you, it moves you. There are things that I read after all these many, many years, and I'm an old man. I'm 75 years old, which I can't read without crying. They made me cry when I was 20, and they still make me cry. A lot of Yeats, actually. It just wipes me out when I read it. I don't think you can control these tears. Now, The strange thing is that you can't control what people weep at. In other words, people might weep at something that truly is pathetic or sentimental, but that doesn't mean that their tears are not genuine. Those are the people that I think are open to art. The problem is that they never expose to art. They're, as I've said before, but I borrowed this idea from William Carlos Williams a long time ago. Williams said, basically, and I'm trivializing this in a way, but basically what he said was, the people who are really deserving of really good art are the people who never see it. They're the ones who are never allowed to see it because they're told from the time they're little, especially if you're born in a certain kind of place, like where I was born. What? You want to, what, read a book? It's like they're told they can't read this stuff. They can't read it. So art is found, like in Williams's, I think it's Spring and All, perhaps he says it. He's talking about crappy, like, you know, circus performances or like vaudeville or like a burlesque show, dumb movies, best-selling crappy novels. And Williams then says, after he presents you with all this trash that's in the world at his time, this is in the 1920s, he then says, but it at least it is the beginning of art. Is the beginning of art. But then these people who are presented with this, which they understand completely and get and weep at and laugh at, they never take that next step because they're told they can't. You're not permitted to do this in this particular. And if you break free of this, you're a weird person. I mean, you know, anybody born and brought up in a working class neighborhood, when you start to see, when that door opens a little and you see there's a world outside of the pool room and the candy store, and maybe you don't have to wind up being a cop or working for civil service or a longshoreman. Maybe you don't have to be that. Well, you're marginalized. You have to keep it quiet. You have to shut your mouth about it. Because the guys you grew up with, the people you grew up with, stop understanding you. And you can't bring them along. I mean, they weep, you weep. You're weeping about different things, and yet their sadness is genuine.
I think that if this culture has been successful, witness an entire presidential campaign several months ago in which the subject of culture or art funding for the never occurred. I mean, it was once an argument about how to do such a thing or what was valuable was transgressive art to be funded by the government. But no. I feel that they've succeeded in teaching us that we don't need it, that it's not for us, it was not made for the likes of us, it is against us, and we must find a way to bury whatever dark, sinister qualities
that art may have,
because it may make us dislike our lives. And to dislike our lives is the beginning of reaction.
It might stop buying things.
Exactly. But that's what we have here. You know, they talk about the society of the spectacle. In Lunar Follies, everything that you can think of is put in a gallery on display. There are some things that are hilarious. There are models, because after all, fashion is art, isn't it?
Oh, sure. That's my favorite chapter, the one about fashion.
They're wearing corn husks that are charged, you know, corrugated, and $2,500. The seams will rip, but nevertheless, there it is. They make fashion art. So the idea here is somehow or other that if we can put it on display, the gallery will turn it into art. It's not the artist or the genuineness of the feeling. It will be entrapped within the eyes of a kind of merciless process of putting on display and of buying that will obviate any feeling or looking whatsoever.
That sort of process, just because of its very fact, dilutes art. One of the strange things, I've been accused many times of being cynical about this particular thing, among many others, but one of them is that I've always had the notion that the people who are, many people who believe that they really love art a lot, right, are the people who are maybe very, very dangerous to art. And I see my terribly cynical vision of this being borne out over the last 10 years. An example is the New York Times. If you read the Times, the Sunday Styles page is just astonishing page, because it's arty, it's hip, it's thin, it's valueless. And it's all, everything's on the same weird plane, so that, like, there's a little squib about, like, you know, Philip Roth's new book, cheek by jowl with, like, a pair of, like, $385 jeans designed by some guy who lives in Romania. And it's all the same. It's, like, the same. The jeans are Philip Roth. It's like, it doesn't, Philip Roth doesn't matter. It's, he's the jeans designer. The jeans designer might as well have written Moby Dick. I mean, it's all the same. It's like there's something really terrible with this. And if you confronted the people who write, and it's written in this terrible kind of breezy, hip, I've been there and done that prose, written by people who are like 26 years old. They don't know anything. They came to New York like 3 years ago, and they're telling me about New York, for Christ's sake. I mean, this is ridiculous. And yet they... These people, if you said to them, you're a Philistine, you know nothing about art or quality or value, you don't know anything, they would look at you as if you're completely nuts and say, what? I graduated from Swarthmore.
How could I be wrong?
How could I be wrong?
Well, I want to say it because I don't think it's been, in fact, it strikes me that the work of Gilbert Sorrentino, your work, is not so much about the attack on the conspiracy of bad art and the things that promote it, so much as that thing that Peter Handke calls a moment of pure feeling. That is to say, how would it be within the downward motion of all things that a moment of true feeling can be caught and preserved amongst the welter of a culture that has nothing to do,
nothing to do with it,
with purity or with feeling or with moments.
That's the trick.
I've been speaking to Gilbert Sorrentino, the author most recently of Lunar Follies, published by Coffee House Press. Thank you, Gilbert, for joining
My
me.
My great pleasure, Michael.
Thanks.
Today's program was recorded in the Library of Lannan Foundation in Santa Fe with technical assistance at KCRW from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.